you are diluting the tanha that reinforces the bounds of self. This dynamic comes through clearly in the final passage from my notes. As I observed my aversion and my wrath, and these feelings lost their power, there was a moment when I imagined that feeling in my gut and his snoring as a kind of single system or organism, unified by communication. In other words, I focused on the continuous stream of sound waves that had emanated from his nose, entered my brain, and elicited the aversion and wrath. For a moment, the annoyer and the annoyed weren't two rigidly distinct things, a he and an I. My boundaries became more porous as the power of tanha, of my aversion to the snoring, waned. So Miri al-Bahari's view of the self and of the self's connection to tanha has one very welcome effect. It makes me seem like a more impressive meditator than I might otherwise seem like. Not only did my wrath zapping involve a bit of the interior, not self-experience, in the sense that I disowned the wrath as I zapped it. In overcoming the tanha that had fueled the wrath, I'd also realized a bit of the more elusive exterior version of the not-self-experience. And this exterior part of the experience, like the interior part, seems to have briefly made me a better person. Two Sermons and Three Poisons. Al-Bahari's view has one other virtue. It helps solve a puzzle posed by early Buddhist scripture. In the Buddha's first discourse after his enlightenment, the sermon at Deer Park, he says that the key to liberation from dukkha is overcoming tanha. But in his second discourse, the discourse on not-self, it seems that liberation lies in recognizing that the self doesn't exist. All the monks who hear this sermon are instantly liberated. So which is it? Does nirvana come by conquering tanha or by seeing that the self is an illusion? Well, maybe the two are one and the same. We might have suspected as much even without al-Bahari's take on things. After all, the interior version of the not-self experience involves disowning feelings and disowning thoughts laden with feelings. And feelings tend to come in the two basic flavors of positive and negative, possessing an element, respectively, of attraction or of aversion. In other words, possessing tanha. So the interior not-self-experience inherently involves letting go of some tanha. Indeed, the Buddha said much the same thing in emphasizing that the not-self-experience involves ceasing to cling to, ceasing to lust after, thoughts and emotions and the like. But al-Bahari adds a new dimension to this argument for a kind of equivalence between the Buddha's first two sermons by connecting the exterior not-self-experience to the abandonment of tanha. When you think about it, it makes sense that tanha would be tied to our outer limits, no less than to our core. From a Darwinian perspective, tanha was engineered into us so that we would take care of ourselves, which is to say, so that each of us would take care of the vehicle that contains our genes. And that vehicle stops at the skin, at the bounds of the body. It's only natural, then, that tanha would reinforce a sense of the importance of those bounds, the bounds that define the zone of concern that natural selection assigned to it. The connection between tanha and our sense of self nicely frames a refrain that appears over and over in Buddhist texts. The refrain warns people to avoid the three poisons of raga, dvesha, and moha. These three words are typically translated as greed, hatred, and delusion, a phrase that will be familiar to many meditators who have heard it roll off the tongues of meditation teachers, sometimes during Dharma talks at retreats. But this translation is in some ways misleading. The word for greed refers not just to greed in the sense of thirst for material possessions, but also to thirst in a more general sense, to any grasping attraction to things. And the word for hatred can mean not just negative feelings toward people, but also negative feelings toward anything, all feelings of aversion. In other words, The first two poisons are the two sides of tanha, a craving for the pleasant, an aversion to the unpleasant. Well, if tanha is indeed tightly bound up with the sense of self, then it makes sense to see these two poisons as bound up with the third poison, delusion. After all, one of the most famous delusions in all of Buddhism is the illusion of self. So the first two poisons, you might say, are the ingredients of the third poison. Raga plus vesha equals moha. This equation makes even more sense when you throw in that other famous delusion, the illusion of essence, and its corresponding grand insight, emptiness. Our intuition that things have essence, I argued in the previous chapter, is shaped by the feelings that infiltrate our perception of these things. On close inspection, these feelings would tend to be either positive or negative, involving either attraction to things, a kind of craving for them, or aversion to things. In other words, these feelings would tend to involve, in at least some measure, either raga or vesha. So in this case, the case of the mistaken perception of essence, the third poison, delusion, does again seem to boil down to the other two poisons. In light of all this, it's only logical that in some ancient texts, liberation is said to involve eradicating the three poisons. After all, this eradication would mean both an end to tanha, the great cause of suffering identified in the Buddha's first sermon, and an end to the illusion of self, the great impediment to liberation laid out in the Buddha's second sermon, not to mention an end to the illusion of essence, an illusion that, especially in the Mahayana tradition, is also seen as an impediment to liberation. Once, Gary Weber, trying to describe his state of consciousness, a state apparently featuring little, if any, sense of self or of essence, said to me, "It's a space you can't imagine bringing anything in to improve it or taking anything away that would make it better." He was basically describing the opposite of tanha. Tanha's premise, after all, is that things can always be made better by taking something away or adding something. Part of tanha's job description is to never be satisfied. Weber doesn't refer to the state he's in as nirvana or call himself enlightened, but the way he talks about his self, or his lack thereof, makes him sound like he's not far from meeting the criterion for enlightenment laid down in the Buddha's second discourse, the discourse on not self. In any event, Weber's a lot closer to that than I am. Still, at that moment when the bird's song seemed no less and no more a part of me than the tingling in my foot, I think I got a sense of what it would be like to be much farther down the meditative path than I am. And it felt very, very good. For that matter, abandoning the tanha that had been energizing my growing dislike of that snoring meditator also made me feel a lot better than I'd felt before. That it made me a better person, however briefly, is a nice bonus. 14. Nirvana in a Nutshell. The rock group Nirvana, which became world famous in the early 1990s, wasn't always known as Nirvana. In its early years, it went under a series of other names. One of them was Bliss. Some people might ask, what's the difference? Aren't Nirvana and Bliss the same thing? As we've seen, the answer is no. Nirvana does entail bliss, but it entails a lot more than bliss, most notably enlightenment. Bhikkhu Bodhi, the prolific translator of Buddhist texts, including many that characterize Nirvana, described it as a state of perfect happiness, complete peace, complete inner freedom, and full awakening and understanding. Another difference between bliss and nirvana is how easy they are to attain. If you're pursuing bliss, period, you can just take bliss-inducing drugs, an approach that is guaranteed to work for a while, though unlikely to work in the long run. Kurt Cobain, the lead singer of Nirvana, became a heroin addict and committed suicide. If you pursue nirvana rather than mere bliss, the approach is less straightforward and more arduous. And even if you're diligent, you are, it is safe to say, less likely to attain nirvana than Cobain was to attain, however fleetingly, bliss. On the other hand, whatever measure of contentment you do attain will almost certainly be more enduring and stable than Cobain's bliss was. This concept of nirvana occupies a unique place in Buddhist thought, not just because it represents the culmination of the Buddhist path, and not just because it represents the nicest imaginable place to be, but also because of the way it straddles the two sides of Buddhism. There is the side of Buddhism this book has been about, the naturalistic side, featuring ideas that would fit easily into a college psychology or philosophy course. And then there is the side of Buddhism featuring supernatural and exotic ideas that would be more at home in the religion department. Nirvana certainly has its exotic aspects. Buddhists who believe in reincarnation see nirvana as the thing that can free them from an otherwise endless cycle of rebirth. But this story about nirvana, the story about how exactly you find the escape hatch from endless rebirth, leads seamlessly to a more naturalistic story about nirvana, a claim about the mechanics of suffering and of contentment. And in the process of following one story to the other, you can see mindfulness meditation in a new light, a light that emphasizes what a radical undertaking it can be. In ancient texts, nirvana is often described with a word that is commonly translated as the unconditioned. For years I heard this strange-sounding term and wondered what it meant, but I figured that understanding it without actually reaching nirvana was probably hopeless and, for my purposes, not all that important. It turns out I was wrong on both counts. The question, what is the unconditioned, has a pretty clear answer and a very important one, an answer that forms a kind of intersection between the exotically metaphysical and the naturalistic. One obvious approach to deciphering the unconditioned is to drop the un and ask what conditioned means. The conditioned, in Buddhist terminology, can be thought of as roughly synonymous with the caused, which makes sense. After all, when we talk about the conditions that give rise to something, the conditions that lead water to boil, or rain to fall, or the crime rate to rise, we're basically saying these conditions are involved in the causal chain that led to that something. Things that are conditioned in the Buddhist sense are things that are subject to causes. So if nirvana is the unconditioned, then you might think it would involve some kind of escape from the caused. And you would be right. But what does that mean? The answer to that question involves one of the most important terms in Buddhism, paticca samuppada. It is a term that has numerous applications and numerous translations. This is actually the same term that in Chapter 13 was translated as interdependent co-arising, another common rendering. However, these are more than just alternative translations for the same term. This term, like some other terms in Buddhism and other traditions, has come to be applied in different ways. When the term is applied to the concept of emptiness, one translation is more apt and illuminating. And when the term is applied to the concept of nirvana, another translation is more apt and illuminating. For present purposes, when we're using it to illuminate the logic of nirvana, a good translation is conditioned arising. In its most generic sense, conditioned arising refers to the basic idea of causality. Out of certain conditions, some things arise. Out of other conditions, other things arise. But the term is also used to refer to a specific sequence of causal links, a series of 12 conditions, one giving rise to the next, that are said to enslave human beings in the cycle of endless rebirth. It is this chain of causal links that nirvana is said to break. I won't run through the exact sequence of 12 conditions, partly because some of them are, for my money, a little murky. But the part of the sequence that concerns us, the part that puts a finer point on nirvana in both the exotic and the naturalistic senses of the term, is reasonably clear. That part starts after a person's sensory faculties, eyes, ears, tongue, etc., have taken shape. It is through these faculties that the person's consciousness makes contact with the material world, or, as it is put more formally in ancient texts that spell out the 12 causal links, through the condition of the sensory faculties, contact arises. And here is the next link. Through the condition of contact, feelings arise, which makes sense because, remember, in the Buddhist view and in the view of many modern psychologists, the things we perceive through our sense organs tend to come with feelings attached, however subtle the feelings. Then, in the next causal link, feelings give rise to tanha, to craving. We crave the pleasant feelings and crave to escape the unpleasant feelings. Let's freeze frame right here, because this is where the action is. Here is how Bhikkhu Bodhi put it in a series of lectures he recorded in 1981. It is here in this space between feeling and craving that the battle will be fought, which will determine whether bondage will continue indefinitely into the future, or whether it will be replaced by enlightenment and liberation. For if instead of yielding to craving, to the driving thirst for pleasure, if a person contemplates with mindfulness and awareness the nature of feelings and understands these feelings as they are, then that person can prevent craving from crystallizing and solidifying. This is where we start to segue from the exotic to the naturalistic. The liberation that Bhikkhu Bodhi is talking about is, in the first instance, a liberation from perpetual rebirth, a liberation that will fully kick in at the end of this life cycle. But it is also liberation in the here and now, liberation from the suffering tanha brings, liberation from the craving to capture pleasant feelings and escape unpleasant feelings, liberation from the persistent desire for things to be different than they are. These two senses of liberation are reflected in the Buddhist idea that there are two kinds of nirvana. As soon as you are liberated in the here and now, you enter a nirvana you can enjoy for the rest of your life. Then, after death, which will be your final death, now that you're liberated from the cycles of rebirth, a second kind of nirvana will apply. I'm sorry to say, I can't describe the first kind of nirvana from personal experience, and I'm ambivalent about not being able to describe the second kind. But the main point is that whichever kind of nirvana you're focused on, the mechanics for getting there centrally involve mindfulness meditation, cultivating an awareness of your feelings that fundamentally changes your relationship to them. Regardless of how exotic or practical your aspirations, whether you believe in a cycle of rebirth and want to escape it, or just want to attain complete liberation in the here and now, or just hope to find partial liberation in the here and now, the essential tool for liberation is the same. And accordingly, some of the basic terminology is the same. Even if you're not trying to escape an eternal repetition of 12 successive conditions, even if you would just like your one and only life to be better, you are still seeking liberation from conditions, from chains of causation that otherwise shackle you. The things in your environment, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the people, the news, the videos, are pushing your buttons, activating feelings that, however subtly, set in motion trains of thought and reaction that govern your behavior, sometimes in ways that are unfortunate, and they will keep doing that unless you start paying attention to what's going on. This has been the point of much of this book. The human brain is a machine designed by natural selection to respond in pretty reflexive fashion to the sensory input impinging on it. It is designed, in a certain sense, to be controlled by that input. And a key cog in the machinery of control is the feelings that arise in response to the input. If you interact with those feelings via tanha, via the natural, reflexive thirst for the pleasant feelings and the natural reflexive aversion to the unpleasant feelings, you will continue to be controlled by the world around you. But if you observe those feelings mindfully, rather than just reacting to them, you can in some measure escape the control. The causes that ordinarily shape your behavior can be defied, and you can get closer to the unconditioned. How weird is the unconditioned? There are debates within Buddhism about how dramatically to conceive of nirvana and the unconditioned. Is there something like a transcendent, metaphysical space that you in some sense occupy, once fully liberated? Or is it a bit more mundane, just freedom from the mindless reactivity to causes, to conditions that would otherwise control you? People who embrace a naturalistic Buddhism and don't believe in rebirth tend to go with the less dramatic interpretation. Indeed, some of them don't like the term the unconditioned because it sounds so dramatic. Stephen Batchelor, a longtime proponent of secular Buddhism and the author of the book Buddhism Without Beliefs, has written, "There is no such thing as the unconditioned, only the possibility of not being conditioned by something." Personally, I wouldn't discourage even secular Buddhists from using the term the unconditioned. Thinking of complete liberation in the here and now as a kind of zone, a metaphorical, if not a metaphysical zone, may be useful. And it may be useful regardless of whether you think the zone is realistically reachable, or just think of it as something you can get closer and closer to. I can testify that it's possible to get into something that feels like a zone. When I phoned my wife after my first meditation retreat, she said I sounded like a completely different person before I had even said anything about the retreat or said anything of substance at all. The very tenor of my voice sounded different, she said, and she liked the new tenor a lot. Now I grant you that this may have been more of a comment on the old tenor than on the new tenor. A few years earlier, trying to articulate what she liked about my brother, she had looked at me and said, "He's like a nice version of you." She laughed when she said it, which I take as a good sign. Anyway, the point is that there had been a real change of tenor. Certainly the world as I saw it had a new tenor. I had shed so much of my usual self-absorption that I could take a new kind of delight in the people and things around me. I was more open, suddenly inclined to strike up conversations with strangers. The world seemed newly vibrant and resonant. There's something ironic about the zone I was in. Science, in its displacement of traditionally religious worldviews, is sometimes said to have brought on the disenchantment of the world, draining it of magic. And you would think that a meditative discipline devoted, in some sense, to tamping down the influence of feelings on perception, to fostering a view of sober clarity, would only abet that tendency. But Batchelor says meditative practice can lead to the re-enchantment of the world, and I know what he means. After that first retreat, I felt like I was living in a zone of enchantment, a place of wonder and preternatural beauty. No, that's not the same as entering a zone that is magically impervious to causation. I was still reacting at least somewhat reflexively to the causes impinging on me. Still, one source of the enchantment, I think, was that I was spending less time reacting, less time having my buttons pushed, and more time observing, which, as a bonus, allowed for more thoughtful responses to things. I assume living in the unconditioned would be great. But living in the less conditioned can be pretty great, too. You could take many of the Buddhist ideas we've covered in this book and recast them in terms of the conditioned, the caused. Indeed, you could say that Buddhist philosophy consists largely of taking the idea of causality really, really seriously. Consider the idea of not-self. What we call the self is in such constant causal interaction with its environment is so pervasively influenced by the world out there as to raise doubts about how firm the boundaries of the self, and for that matter, the core of the self, really are. Remember how the Buddha emphasized in that original not-self sermon that the various things we think of as parts of ourself are, in fact, not under our control? The reason they're not under our control is that, until we're liberated at least, they're under the control of outside forces. They're conditioned. And remember the Buddha's emphasis on the impermanence of the things we think of as parts of the self? This too, the perennial arising and passing away of thoughts, emotions, attitudes, is a consequence of the ever-changing forces that act on us, forces that set off chain reactions inside us. The things inside us are subject to causes, to conditions, and it is the fate of all conditioned things to change when conditions change. And conditions change pretty much all the time. You might say that the path of meditative progress consists largely of becoming aware of the causes impinging on you, aware of the way things manipulate you, and aware that a key link in that manipulation lies in the space where feelings can give rise to tanha, to a craving for pleasant feelings and an aversion to unpleasant feelings. This is the space where mindfulness can critically intervene. Maybe I should have put an asterisk after the word aware in the previous paragraph. I'm not talking about an abstract understanding, an academic awareness of these chains of causality. I'm talking about a carefully cultivated experiential understanding, a mindful awareness that brings the power to break, or at least loosen, the chains. That said, undergirding this experiential understanding and often accompanying it is the more abstract understanding that is part of Buddhist philosophy. Making real progress in mindfulness meditation almost inevitably means becoming more aware of the mechanics by which your feelings, if left to their own devices, shape your perceptions, thoughts, and behavior, and becoming more aware of the things in your environment that activate those feelings in the first place. You could say that enlightenment in the Buddhist sense has something in common with enlightenment in the Western scientific sense. It involves becoming more aware of what causes what. All of this flies in the face of stereotype. Mindfulness meditation is often thought of as warm and fuzzy and, in a way, anti-rational. It is said to be about getting in touch with your feelings and not making judgments. And yes, it does involve those things. It can let you experience your feelings, anger, love, sorrow, joy, with new sensitivity, seeing their texture, even feeling their texture, as never before. And the reason that is possible is that you are, in a sense, not making judgments. That is, you are not mindlessly labeling your feelings as bad or good, not fleeing from them or rushing to embrace them. So you can stay close to them, yet not be lost in them. You can pay attention to what they actually feel like. Still, you do this not in order to abandon your rational faculties, but rather to engage them. You can now subject your feelings to a kind of reasoned analysis that will let you judiciously decide which ones are good guiding lights. So what not making judgments ultimately means is not letting your feelings make judgments for you. And what getting in touch with your feelings ultimately means is not being so oblivious to them that you get pushed around by them. And all of this means informing your responses to the world with the clearest possible view of the world. Underlying this whole endeavor is a highly mechanistic conception of how the mind works. The idea is to finally sense the workings of the machine and use that understanding to rewire it, to subvert its programming, to radically alter its response to the causes, the conditions impinging on it. Doing this doesn't let you enter the unconditioned in the strict sense. It doesn't let you literally escape the realm of cause and effect. Then again, airplanes don't literally defy the law of gravity, but they still fly. I don't want to overstate the parallels between the Buddhist and Western conceptions of enlightenment. Buddhist philosophy and modern science have different modes of inquiry, different standards of evidence. But lately the two traditions have started to interact in fruitful ways. There are brain scans of meditators, studies about the physiological and psychological effects of meditation, and so on. Yet the most momentous interaction, I think, began in the mid-19th century with the theory of natural selection. For more than two millennia, Buddhism had been studying how the human mind is programmed to react to its environment, how exactly the conditioning works. Now, with Darwin's theory, we understood what had done the programming. And over the ensuing century and a half, as Darwinian theory matured and evidence accumulated, we got a clearer and clearer idea of the details of that programming. I think all of this puts us in a position to approach nirvana from a whole new angle, to mount a new kind of argument in defense of the basic validity of Buddhist enlightenment. That is the subject of the next chapter. 15. Is enlightenment enlightening? Over the ages, the equation of enlightenment and liberation has assumed many forms and found many audiences. The original headquarters of the CIA had Jesus' version of the equation etched in its wall, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And the movie The Matrix, as we saw at the outset of this book, offers a truth-freedom linkage that echoes Buddhist philosophy. Life as ordinarily lived is a kind of illusion, and you can't be truly free until you pierce the illusion and look into the heart of things. Until you see it for yourself, as Morpheus puts it to Neo, you will remain in bondage. But there are important differences between the Matrix scenario and the Buddhism scenario. For starters, the truth in the Matrix is easier to describe. Sure, Morpheus says you have to see it for yourself, but the fact is that he could have given Neo a pretty clear verbal picture of it. Robot overlords have put humans in gooey pods and are pumping dreams into their brains. There, how complicated was that? Certainly, it's an easier claim to grasp than, say, that the self doesn't exist or that everything is empty. There's another sense in which those robot overlords give Neo's predicament an appealing simplicity. Namely, they give him something to rebel against, and rebellions are energizing. An oppressive enemy focuses the mind and steals you for the struggle ahead, which would come in handy with meditation because it really can be a struggle, getting on the cushion every day, even when you don't feel like it, and then trying to carry mindfulness into everyday life. Too bad that in Buddhism, there's no evil perpetrator of delusion to fight. In traditional Buddhism, actually there is. The Satan-like supernatural being named Mara, who unsuccessfully tempted the Buddha during the epic meditation session that led to his great awakening. Mara, though, has no place in the Western, more secular Buddhism that is the backdrop of this book. Kind of disappointing. But there's good news on this front. If you would like to think of meditation practice as being a rebellion against an oppressive overlord, we can arrange that. Just think of yourself as fighting your creator, natural selection. After all, natural selection, like the robot overlords, engineered the delusions that control us. It built them into our brains. If you're willing to personify natural selection, you can carry the comparison with robot overlords a bit further. Natural selection perpetrated the delusion in order to get us to adhere slavishly to its agenda. Its agenda being, of course, to get genes into the next generation. This is the core of natural selection's value system, the criterion that guided the engineering of our brains. And we have every right to decide, like Neo, that our values differ from those of the force that controls us, and that we want liberation from it, which means, first and foremost, liberating ourselves from the delusions through which that control is exercised. This declaration of independence is, of course, in no way undermined by the irony that, in a modern environment, these delusions often fail to serve natural selection's agenda of genetic proliferation anyway. There's a second virtue of thinking of the Buddhist path as a rebellion against natural selection. Looking at things that way helps us put a finer point on what we mean by liberation and by enlightenment. And it helps us answer the big question, is enlightenment really enlightening? I mean, obviously enlightenment is enlightening, that's why they call it enlightenment. But is the Buddhist version of enlightenment, the end state, enlightenment with a capital E, enlightening? Is it a radically truer view of things than our ordinary experience? Is it the ultimate truth? I've argued in this book that when you meditate, you may, in various senses, see things a bit more clearly than you saw them before, and that this clarity can grow, increment by increment. But what about the sum of all increments? What if you made it to the end of the path? Would enlightenment be a pure, unadulterated view of truth? This may seem like a moot point, since most of us have little realistic hope of attaining full enlightenment. Still, to say that you'll never reach something isn't the same as saying you're not approaching it. Even if enlightenment is an idealized, hypothetical state we'll never experience, even if it's an idealized, hypothetical state that no one will experience and no one has ever experienced, it's what the meditative path is in theory headed toward. So if we want to know whether we're moving toward the truth, and whether we'll still be moving toward the truth no matter how far we go, it would help to know if this state is the truth itself. The Enlightenment Checklist. We should start with a basic question. What is enlightenment? How would the world look if you were enlightened in the Buddhist sense of the term? Well, broadly speaking, the answer is that you would see the truth of the central ideas of Buddhist philosophy. And when I say see the truth, I mean see the truth. Actually apprehend the truth experientially. It's one thing to be led intellectually to the conclusion that, say, the self doesn't exist. As we've seen, there are psychologists and philosophers who have been led to suspect as much by some combination of data and logic and introspection. But most of them haven't had the kind of powerful experience of not-self that can impart deep conviction, a conviction that surpasses intellectual persuasion in its power to change lives. So too with the idea of emptiness or formlessness. There are philosophical arguments for this idea, and some people find them persuasive. But attaining enlightenment would involve being experientially, not just intellectually, convinced. Seeing, so to speak, the emptiness. Okay, so not self and emptiness. What other things would you have to see to qualify as enlightened? Well, there's no single official definition of enlightenment that has been endorsed by Buddhists of all stripes. There's no list of prerequisites for an enlightenment certificate that you can check off. But if there were such a thing, an enlightenment checklist, it wouldn't, by mainstream Buddhist reckoning, end with these two experiences, fundamental though they are. We've already seen a few additional bullet points on that list, some of which are more like insights, such as seeing the impermanence of everything, and some of which are more like feats, such as overcoming tanha or craving. It turns out that there are various other feats listed in one Buddhist text or another that are linked to enlightenment. There is the overcoming of specific fetters, such as lust and conceit and ill will, and there is compliance with the precepts laid out in the Eightfold Path, don't steal, harm other beings, indulge in malicious gossip, and so on. So enlightenment in the fullest, most traditionally Buddhist sense, isn't confined to the metaphysical dimension that has dominated this book, the idea that reality, both inside and outside of us, is very different than it seems. There are also explicitly moral dimensions. On the other hand, as we've seen, in Buddhist thought, the metaphysical and the moral are linked. Meditatively apprehending Buddhism's central metaphysical claims is said to erode the psychological roots of bad behavior. Indeed, letting go of things like lust and conceit and ill will is an intrinsic part of the metaphysical apprehension known as not-self. It's this metaphysical moral linkage, the fact that certain moral values are implied by metaphysical enlightenment, that makes the clearer perception of reality tantamount to a rebellion against natural selection. The particular values implied by this clarity, the values you would fully embody if you reached full enlightenment, are in many ways directly at odds with the values implied by our ordinary view of reality, the values that natural selection embedded in that view. Well, aren't we special? Consider for starters what some would call the core experience of enlightenment, the not-self experience. More specifically, consider the subset of it that I've called the exterior not-self experience. How does this experience imply a rejection of natural selection's values? As we've seen, the experience involves a diminished sense of separation between you, or you, and the other people and things in the world. In fact, there's such a sense of continuity between your inside and the world on the outside that you may start to see harming others as tantamount to harming yourself. In the fullest version of this experience, you start to doubt that there's any real difference between their interests and yours. Well, from natural selection's point of view, this is heresy. If there's one idea that natural selection has built into me, it's that I have distinctive interests and should focus on them. On those occasions when some of my interests overlap with the interests of others, then fine, we can do business. But if there's no such overlap, my interests take priority. This principle follows from the logic of natural selection. If inside me are genes that were selected because they've been good at getting copies of themselves into the next generation, then job one for these genes will be to take care of the vehicle that can carry them there, that is, my body. And that means these genes will build into my brain the idea that taking care of this body is much more important than taking care of other bodies, except perhaps when those other bodies belong to close kin. In other words, I'm special. My specialness lies very near the heart of natural selection's value system. This premise is built into all animal life, and you see it in all kinds of ways. Animals kill each other, for example. That includes human animals, though often humans assert their specialness more subtly, as when they peacefully undermine rivals. Indeed, the premise of our specialness informs our most pedestrian behavior. If you're trying to hail a cab, and you notice that someone next to you is also trying to hail a cab, you naturally reach your arm higher so that you'll get the cab and she won't, even though, for all you know, your rival is a physician who is on her way to save somebody's life. So this one element of enlightenment, the exterior version of the not-self experience, with its dissolution of the bounds between you and the world, hence a constant continuity of interest between you and all of life, involves abandoning one of the most basic precepts built into us by natural selection, that I am special by virtue of being me. Now that's rebellion. But is it truth? Are the values of natural selections that are being rejected in the course of enlightenment actually false? Yes, in some sense. Consider the absurdity of the current situation. This planet is full of people operating on the premise that their interests trump the interests of pretty much everyone else on the planet. Yet it can't be the case that everybody is more important than everybody else. So a core tenet of natural selection's value system is internally contradictory. Rejecting it, then, would pretty much have to move you closer to the truth. In the case of the exterior not-self experience, rebellion against the values of our overlord does seem to amount to some measure of enlightenment in the everyday sense of the word. It moves us toward a truer view of the world. And what about the flip side, the interior version of the not-self experience? This version, in which you cease to own your thoughts and feelings, also involves a rejection of natural selection's values. After all, the kinds of thoughts and feelings our brain is inclined to have were initially designed by natural selection to help take care of this vehicle containing our genes. So identifying with these thoughts and feelings, owning them, and thus letting them own us, is often just another way of asserting our specialness. When I'm trying to hail that cab and trying to keep the less worthy person next to me from hailing it, I'm owning my desire to get in a cab ASAP and get to the next stop on my uniquely important itinerary. If I let go of that feeling and cease to identify with it, in other words, take a step toward the interior version of the not-self experience, I'm rejecting natural selection's insistence that I consider myself special. Take that, natural selection. So too with the case of the snoring yogi in the previous chapter. As long as I identified with my dislike of him, I was obeying natural selection's instructions to consider myself special. Certainly more special than a guy who wants to catch up on his sleep when I'm trying to meditate. To the extent that I disowned those feelings, I experienced a bit of not-self and defied natural selection's values. I don't know exactly what it would be like to have the full-on not-self experience, but I've got a feeling that my sense of specialness, of unique privilege, would approach the vanishing point. And if that sense of specialness is indeed false, an illusion implanted in us by natural selection, then exactly to the extent that it did approach the vanishing point, I would be approaching the truth. Emptiness as truth. Aside from not-self, the most famously counterintuitive metaphysical truth claimed by Buddhism is emptiness. Like not-self, emptiness is both a philosophical doctrine and a meditative experience. If you ask Buddhist philosophers to defend the idea of emptiness, they will talk about how everything is too interconnected for anything to have independent, self-sufficient existence. If you ask me to defend the idea of emptiness, I would take a different tack. I'd focus on the experience of emptiness, not the philosophical doctrine, and argue that this experience is in a sense more valid, more truthful, than our ordinary experience of the world. The argument for the truth of emptiness is basically the same as the argument I just made for the truth of not-self. The experience of emptiness, like the experience of not-self, defies and denies natural selection's nonsensical assertion that each of us is more important than the rest of us. But the logic of the argument is less obvious here than it was in the case of not-self. So let's take a closer look at it. Emptiness, you may recall, is, roughly speaking, the idea that things don't have essence. And the perception of essence seems to revolve, however subtly, around feelings. The essence of anything is shaped by the feeling it evokes. It is when things don't evoke much in the way of feelings, when our normal affective reaction to things is subdued, that we see these things as empty or formless. At least, that's my view, a view that draws support from psychology and from the testimony of some very adept meditators. So if you want to know whether emptiness is closer to the truth than our ordinary apprehensions of the world, you might want to ask about the feelings that give us those ordinary apprehensions, the feelings that create the sense of essence. Should the feelings that come naturally to us be trusted as guides to the truth? No one who has read or listened to this book up to this point will now be waiting in suspense for the answer to that question. We've touched on the question in various places, including earlier in this chapter, and consistently, the answer has been that our feelings are in one sense or another dubious guides to reality. So in a way, we've already established that if our intuition that things have essence is indeed informed by subtle feelings we have toward them, this fact alone should inspire doubts about that intuition. But there's a sense in which our feelings deserve even more mistrust than I've suggested so far. It's a pretty cosmic sense, and explaining it will require backing up and revisiting the question of what feelings are for in the first place. But if you can't get cosmic when you're pondering the meaning of enlightenment, when can you get cosmic? So let's back up and revisit. Feelings in cosmic context. At the dawn of organic sentience, when feelings made their first appearance in the living world, their mission was to take care of the organism, specifically to get it to approach things that are good for it, like food, and avoid things that are bad for it, like toxins. As beings got more complex, the behaviors that feelings induced got more complex than just approaching or avoiding. Like, for example, yelling at people who are doing things that are bad for you, and flattering people who might do things that are good for you. Another way to put this is that feelings, viewed in the context of their evolutionary purpose, are implicit judgments about things in the environment, about whether they are good for the organism or bad for the organism, and about what behaviors, approach, avoid, scream, flatter, will be useful for the organism given these judgments. This, as we saw in Chapter 3, suggests one sense in which feelings could be called true or false. Are those judgments accurate or inaccurate? Sometimes, especially in the modern world, they're inaccurate. Witness road rage, rampant anxiety, and various other kinds of feelings that don't serve the interests of the typical 21st century human being. But note that phrase, serve the interests. This whole evaluation, by accepting a particular organism's interests as the criterion for whether judgments are accurate, is accepting natural selection's basic frame of reference, that you, this particular organism, are special. Your interests are the most important interests, and therefore your particular perspective, the perspective that judges everything in relation to those interests, is the appropriate perspective for evaluating the goodness or badness of things in the world. Is that the way feelings and the perceptions they foster should be evaluated? From your particular perspective, or for that matter, from anyone's particular perspective? Before we go further, I want to assure you that I'm not going to suggest that you start ignoring all your self-serving feelings. It makes sense for each of us to spend a certain amount of time taking care of ourselves, and for that matter, our loved ones. I don't recommend that you quit doing all the things you've traditionally done on the unspoken premise that you and yours are special. You should keep eating, for example, and brushing your teeth. Imagine how awkward it would be for everyone to brush each other's teeth. And you should drive close kin who are sick to the hospital. Although these kin are in fact not more important than your neighbor's kin, there's a certain social efficiency that results from people caring for other people who conveniently live in their house. It's feelings that motivate you to do these kinds of things, and in these kinds of cases, I say it's fine to trust your feelings. This will, of course, include feelings that inform the sense of essence. Even though, strictly speaking, it's a self-serving feeling that makes your home seem to possess essence of home, I don't see any reason to fight that feeling. It is fine to be drawn into your home, and it will lead to fewer uncomfortable encounters than being drawn into randomly selected homes. And once you're in your home, by all means, feel essence of dog or cat or son or daughter or spouse or partner, unless perhaps domestic tensions have transformed one of these essences from warm and fuzzy to cold and harsh. Up to a point, seeing the world from your particular perspective has its virtues from a standpoint of social efficiency and even social harmony. And yes, simple pleasure. And is a pretty defensible way to approach the bulk of your daily business. But what about when you're not going about your daily business, but rather are asking basic metaphysical questions? What about when you're trying to figure out whether feelings, in informing our sense of essence, are fostering perceptions that are true in some objective sense? Should we ask those kinds of questions from your perspective, or from any particular person's perspective? Einstein and Enlightenment. Einstein became famous by asking a similar question in the realm of physics. He acknowledged that our intuitions about the physical world, about how fast objects move, for example, work fine for the purpose of steering each of us through that world. After all, for practical purposes, what matters is how fast things are moving in relation to us. But, he said, if you want a deeper understanding of physics, you need to detach yourself from your particular perspective, from any particular perspective, and ask, suppose I occupied no vantage point. Since I wouldn't be able to ask how fast things are moving relative to me, what exactly would it mean to ask how fast things are moving? Questions like this led him to the theory of relativity and the realization that E equals mc squared. Well, any path of inquiry that's good enough for Einstein is good enough for me. A type of question that leads humankind to understand the relationship between matter and energy as never before has a pretty good track record when it comes to enlightenment. So let's ask a question about essence that's analogous to the question Einstein asked. What happens to essence when we let go of our particular perspective? The perspective that the feelings that shape the perceived essences of things were designed to serve. I think the answer is that essence disappears. After all, without a perspective to serve, there would be no feelings in the first place. As Robert Zients, the psychologist whose work figured centrally in Chapter 11, explained, affective judgments are always about the self. They identify the state of the judge in relation to the object of judgment. In the absence of a particular point of view, yours or someone else's, the whole idea of an affective judgment, a feeling, makes no sense. If you truly and completely adopt the vantage point Einstein adopted, if you transcend the perspective of the self, any self, and view things from nowhere in particular, essence disappears, along with the feelings that created it in the first place. When we do this, when we transcend the perspective of self, there's a sense in which we're also transcending the perspective of our whole species. After all, the basic thoughts and feelings that guide us through life, the ones designed to take care of us, are, broadly speaking, characteristic of our species. Though the feeling of homeness that my house exudes may be distinctive at a fine-grained level, in a rougher sense, it's the same feeling lots of people have about their homes. But other species, of course, have their own views of things. And if we're going to thoroughly follow Einstein's example and assume that no single perspective has special access to the truth, then we need to transcend not only the perspective of individual people, but also the perspective of our whole species. We need to drop the assumption that the way we look at things is inherently more valid than the way other animals look at things. So, for example, the fear instilled in a human by a snake amounts to a judgment that the snake is bad, something to be avoided. But the lust inspired by that very same snake in a member of its own species means the snake is good, something to be copulated with. Rotting flesh fills us with revulsion because approaching it could bring contact with tiny parasites. But from the point of view of the tiny parasites, rotting flesh is the ideal culinary milieu. And so on. Stagnant, fetid swamps are off-putting unless you're, say, a mosquito or an alligator, in which case they're sublime. Young pandas like a nice meal of mother panda dung. I think I'll pass, thanks. This relativity of judgment is part of what Buddhists mean when they talk about the illusory nature of everyday perceptions. Chandrakirti, an India Buddhist scholar who lived in the 7th century CE, said that what a human would see as water might seem like nectar to a certain kind of god, and like pus or blood to a hungry ghost, and would taste accordingly. A hungry ghost is a type of being I won't bother to describe, except to say that you definitely don't want to be reincarnated as one. If Chandrakirti had been writing after Darwin, he might have put the point this way. Our entire notion of good and bad, our whole landscape of feelings, fear, lust, love, and the many other feelings, salient and subtle, that inform our everyday thoughts and perceptions are products of the particular evolutionary history of our species. If having sex with armadillos had been the only way our ancestors could get their genes into the next generation,